little bit late today since it is the first lecture, and some of you may be unfamiliar with the layout of the grounds here. In the future, we'll like to start promptly at 7:30, so we'll appreciate you being here right on time. And if you want to get here, please close your cup to the door. Before Mr. Long begins, I would like to draw your attention to an upcoming mini expedition we've got going. I think probably you are all interested in astronomy, or you were indeed here in the first place. Listening to a space lecture and reading about space, of course, is fun, but the greatest pleasure comes from getting out and observing the sky for yourself, looking at the splendors of the heavens. On Saturday night, September 29th, you will have such an opportunity. We have a trip called Star Cars, which is scheduled. We're going to begin in the planetarium for a short demonstration, be able to let you see what the night sky will look like, to familiarize you with the autumn constellations. And we'll form a carpool, drive from here over to the Ward Nature Study Area, which is about 7.5 miles to the west of ground in the city of Orchard Lake. We'll set up telescope and look at the real thing. Unfortunately, we don't have any planets in the sky right now to look at. The Ring Nebula is up, the Andromeda Galaxy, star clusters, many other interesting objects will be visible. We're encouraging everybody who wants to go to bring a telescope. Or if you don't have that, bring binoculars. Or if you don't have that, bring yourself. There'll be plenty of people there, we hope, a lot of telescopes. There'll be a good chance to talk to people about their telescopes if you have wanted to buy one and didn't know what sort of things to look for. There should be reflectors and refractors, both kinds. This is on Saturday night, September 29th, weather permitting. There is a registration fee, which is $8, $6 for Institute members, and registration is required. So if you're interested, do call us at the education office between 9 to 5, Monday through Friday. I've been informed that somebody driving an astronomical car, a beige Nova, left your headlights on in the parking lot. Jim Loudon is a lecturer, teacher, media commentator on space and astronomy. He reported the Pioneer Venus probe, Soviet Venus landing, Voyager 1 and 2 encounters. He's reported for National Public Radio and the Canadian Broadcasting Corporation, plus appearing in magazines such as Sky and Telescope and Technology Review. He has lectured at the Institute many times. Each one of his lectures, including this one, was completely sold out. He's lectured between Massachusetts and Illinois. He's been a very busy person. I would say that business for him is looking up. He has an astronomy degree from the Universities of Pennsylvania and Michigan, and he's staff astronomer for the University of Michigan's Exhibit Museum. Without further delay, it gives me great pleasure to introduce one of the most spaced out people I know, Jim Loudon.
Thank you very much. Testing 1, 2, is it working? Can you hear me in the back? If so, do you hear me through loudspeakers or through my own voice? There we go, great, great. Thank you very much for that kind introduction. SpaceF, huh? Okay, I think I thank you for that kind introduction. I do give a lot of lectures all over the place, and rather than bore you with an extensive description of all of them, I will say that for anybody who didn't pick up our schedule in the back, it is in the back, and there are plenty of them, and they're free, and worth at least twice as much. They list everything that has anything to do with astronomy or space, and is open to the public, number one, which in some way is connected with the University of Michigan, number two. And so it includes not only my lectures around the state, but also the open houses of the telescopes and the astronomy department visitors' nights lectures and so forth and so on. And, well, as I say, it's in the back. This past year has been literally without precedent in human history in the now over 21, in fact, next month, 22-year history of the space age for the number and variety and importance of planetary exploration missions that have taken place. We are undergoing, because of course the data are still being analyzed, will be for many years. We are undergoing a genuine revolution in our knowledge of the solar system. We have something like doubled the number of terrestrial-type planets that we have examined first, first up. By terrestrial type, I mean the solid bodies like the Earth and the Moon and Mars, and by planets, I mean a large object of that sort, irrespective of whether it's revolving directly around the sun or revolves around some other planet. And what all that's referring to is that both Jupiter and Saturn have moons, which are full-size planets in themselves.
Five of them, four of Jupiter, one of Saturn, are bigger than the planet Pluto. Three of them are bigger than Mercury. And until this year, they were simply dots of light in our best telescopes. Especially with the moons of Jupiter, we had, for four of the big ones and one of the small ones, the truly unbelievable experience of having entire worlds, one after another, suddenly become known in the space of a few hours each. Where before the spacecraft, the two Voyager spacecraft got to Jupiter, they were simply dots of light in our best telescopes. We knew nothing about them. And now we have pictures of much or all of their surfaces in at least the detail that we have in the best Earth-based pictures of our own moon. We will be seeing even more of that next year when Voyager 1 gets to Saturn and sends back even more entire new worlds seen for the first time close up, because Saturn has even more accessible moons than Jupiter does. By accessible moons, I mean ones that are close enough into the planet that you can schedule a spacecraft flyby so that it can reasonably fly past them. Then Voyager 2 gets to Saturn the year after, and if all goes well, Voyager 2 will go on to Uranus and be able to give us a close-up view of at least one of its moons. It may even be able to go on to Neptune and get one or both of the moons that Neptune has. So this is just the beginning of an extremely exciting period. I'm going to tell you as much as I can in five lectures, and believe me, if I had 50, I'd be starting out the same way. You know, there's so much material, there's no way you can get it all in. I'm going to tell you as much as I can in the space we have, the time we have available, and invite you to keep coming back for continuing updates, both here and elsewhere as I give lectures around this area. If you have questions at any point, please ask them as we go along. We're going to turn the lights out in a minute so you won't be able to see me, so don't bother to raise your hand. Just yell question or Jim or yell funny looking or anything that you think will get my attention. I will answer to virtually anything not actually obscene or libelous. And, you know, I'd much rather, if I say something and you don't understand it, that we get it settled on at the moment, you know, rather than having you sit there for 2 hours and then finally at the end find out what you would have understood if I'd only bothered to explain it to you at the time. So please do. We're going to start out chronologically, as this year did. Actually, it's a period of somewhat less than a year that began last December. And that month saw the greatest single invasion of any planet by scientific spacecraft that has ever happened, aside from the Earth itself. In that one month, 10 separate spacecraft of two nations arrived at Venus. It is probably true that we learned more about Venus in that one month than we had, more about planetary atmospheres, in fact, in that one month than we had in all of the centuries of study to date. Some of you, I know, attended the series that I gave before this remarkable year started, in which I told you what we knew about the various worlds that were involved at that time, and explain in detail what we hope the various missions were going to accomplish. I'm going to duplicate as little of that material as I can manage, because I don't want to bore you with old stuff, and we've got so much new stuff, and there isn't time for everything anyway. However, obviously, for those of you who were not at the previous lectures, I can't just assume that you know all about Pioneer Venus. So I'm going to spend the next few minutes going over some stuff that I know will be familiar to some of you. Let me ask, in fact, just out of curiosity, how many of you did attend that previous series? I was afraid of that, about half, or less than half. Okay, well, I'll promise you that at least 85% of this material in this series is going to be brand new material that I didn't give you before, but we have to go over a little of what was already known just to orient the rest. So if we have the lights off and the first slide on, I will show you some pictures of Venus as it appears from Earth. And if people are not very familiar with astronomy, especially kids, their first reaction when they see these pictures is often, gee, it looks just like the moon. By which they mean, of course, it shows phases. Well, that's simply due to the fact that it does not emit any light of its own, and it's a spherical body, and the only reason we see it is that light from the sun reflects off it, and so half of it is lighted up at any time, half of it is dark, and depending on which direction we happen to be from it, we see one phase or another. But in fact, the important thing about these pictures is they do not look like the moon. When you look at them, you don't see any craters, you don't see maria, you don't see anything. It's just featureless blank white. And the reason for that turns out to be that Venus is totally covered by clouds, although they are very unlike the clouds that we have on the Earth. I think that before I tell you about those clouds, I think that if you went out on the street and grabbed 100 people at random and asked them the following four questions. Number one, what is the nearest planet to the Earth, or more accurately, what planet can come nearest of all of them? Number two, what planet is the one to which the greatest number of spacecraft have been sent, aside from the Earth and the Moon? Number three, on what planet did humans first successfully land a spacecraft? And number four, from what planet were the first surface pictures sent back?
I'm sure that 95% of your respondents would say, huh? No, I'm sure that 95% of your respondents would say Mars, and in fact they would be wrong, because in all four cases the answer is Venus. Venus can come within 25 million miles of the Earth. For Mars, the figure is 35 million, so that's 10 million miles farther. Venus is the one that to which the greatest number of spacecraft has been sent, mostly because of the Soviet Union, which has had at least 18 separate launches, many of them involving more than one spacecraft, to Venus during the course of the space age. A lot of the early ones were failures, but the Soviets kept at it, and they've had a series of successes. That was also the first planet on which anybody landed. Again, it was the Soviet Union, on which the Russians landed their spacecraft, Venera 7. I'm sorry, it's easy to get these confused. Venera is the Russian word for Venus, and if you were at the last series, you heard me mispronounce it extensively, Venera. I have now heard a Russian say it. It is Venera, and it's the Latin word for Venus, and therefore it's the Russian word for Venus. Venera 7 landed on Venus in December of 1970. That was man's first landing on the surface of another planet. It was reported on page 57 of the New York Times. It's not as though it were an important news item, such as a baseball game. Since then, the Soviets have successfully landed Veneras 8, 9, 10, 11, and 12. I should say 8, 9, 10, 12, and 11, because last December, 12 and 11 landed in that order. I'll tell you later why that was. And they have sent back data from the surface, and in two cases, namely Veneras 9 and 10, in 1975, they sent back pictures from the surface of Venus, and that was nearly an Earth year before the American Viking Lander 1 spacecraft touched down on the surface of Mars and sent back what I imagine most Americans still fondly believe were the first pictures from the surface of Mars. Well, they weren't. Venus is a very interesting planet because it is the only one in the solar system that is the same size as the Earth and weighs the same amount as the Earth, to a very close approximation. You might therefore expect that Venus would be similar to the Earth. Well, to put it mildly, it's not. If you were sitting on the surface of Venus, the first thing that would, let us say, draw itself to your attention would be the temperature, which is remarkably warm. In fact, at the surface of Venus, the temperature is 900 degrees Fahrenheit, which is hot enough to melt lead, tin, or solder, for example, just to give you one tiny hint as to how hard it is to design a spacecraft that can land on the surface of that planet. And it is 900 degrees Fahrenheit day and night, summer and winter, pole and equator. It's always hot enough to melt lead down there. Venus is twice as far from the sun as Mercury. Venus is enough farther from the sun than Mercury that it receives only half as much sunlight, which doesn't mean that it's twice as far, because the amount of sunlight falls off as 1 over the square of the distance out. So it receives about half as much sunlight as Mercury. Since it is totally covered by clouds, those clouds reflect 80% of the sunlight that does hit Venus back into space, and so on 1/5 of 1/2 as much sunlight as reaches the surface of Mercury, Venus manages to be twice as hot. Venus is, in fact, by far the hottest planet in the solar system. The reason for this is the next thing that would commend itself to your attention were you on the surface of Venus, and that is the air pressure, which is almost a ton per square inch at the surface. Venus has an atmosphere that is nearly 100 times as dense as that of the Earth. And it is that atmosphere, we think, that traps heat from the sun, holds it in, heats up the surface, by preventing the heat from escaping into space, and it makes the difference in temperature between Venus and Mercury. This is something called the greenhouse effect. Greenhouse effect simply means that a planet with an atmosphere is warmer than it would be if it didn't have an atmosphere, but were at the same distance from the sun and everything else was the same. You can see a good example of greenhouse effect if you look at the Earth and the Moon. They are both at essentially the same distance from the sun, so you might think they'd be the same temperature. In fact, the average temperature at the surface of the Earth is nearly 100 degrees Fahrenheit warmer than the average temperature at the surface of the Moon. And the reason for that is entirely that the Earth has an atmosphere. Now, Earth's atmospheric greenhouse is due primarily not to the major constituents, the nitrogen and the oxygen that make up the bulk of our air. They both happen to be gases that are very poor at this. Some gases turn out to be very, very much better at this than others. And in fact, our greenhouse is due to trace constituents, water vapor and carbon dioxide. Water vapor makes up at most 1% of the atmosphere at the surface of the Earth. Carbon dioxide is something like 1/20th of 1%. But those tiny amounts of those two materials are able to raise the temperature of the surface of the Earth by 100 degrees over what it would be if we didn't have them. So it's not just a matter of having air, it's a matter of having air with the right kinds of gases in it. Venus has an atmosphere that is not only 100 times as dense as Earth, but it's made please excuse me. I have a very bad cold, and I'm going to have to keep doing this, or we just aren't going to get through the lecture at all. This is water, folks, honest. As I was saying when I so rudely interrupted myself, Venus has an atmosphere that is not only 100 times as dense as Earth, but it is made almost entirely of carbon dioxide. So Venus has something like 20,000 times as much carbon dioxide in its atmosphere as the Earth does in its, and therefore is a great deal warmer. Actually, the carbon dioxide by itself is not enough to make Venus quite as hot as it's observed to be. If Venus had all that carbon dioxide and nothing else, it would be about 700 degrees Fahrenheit at the surface. That's hot, but it's 200 degrees less hot than the real Venus is observed to be. And so part, one of the many things that we hope to learn from that avalanche of data from the spacecraft invasion of Venus last December was what it is that is responsible for the remaining 200 degrees worth. At first we thought we had the answer. The answer was, we thought, other substances in the atmosphere that helped out the carbon dioxide by holding in radiation that at wavelengths the carbon dioxide would have let escape into space, in other words, contributed to the greenhouse effect on their own, and those were water vapor and sulfur dioxide. The earliest results from the Pioneer Venus Large Probe, and I'll explain what that term large probe means a little bit later when I tell you about the mission, the earliest results seem to indicate that Venus had enormously greater amounts of both of those substances below the clouds than it had above them. And that the clouds, in fact, were acting as a chemical barrier and preventing these substances from getting very far into space above them. Or to put it another way, these substances were combining chemically at the level where the clouds are and forming the clouds. Well, that's because we assumed all along that of the two instruments on the Pioneer Venus Large Probe, the Large Probe was just a gadget that went down through the atmosphere of Venus and sent back data about what it was made of along with many other things about it on the way down. And it survived all the way down to the surface. And there were two instruments on the Large Probe that were designed to measure what the air was made of. They have nice frightening names, which I'll give, but I'm not going to try to explain how the gadgets work. One of them was called the Large Probe Neutral Mass Spectrometer, or LNMS, and the other one was called the Large Probe Gas Chromatograph, or LGC. And everybody kind of assumed, as a result of prejudices picked up from earlier space missions, that the mass chromatograph was really the major composition instrument, and that the neutral mass spectrometer was really the major composition instrument, and the gas chromatograph was kind of along for the ride, you know, it was there in case the really important one, the mass spectrometer, failed. And what bothered everybody was the two instruments gave different numbers for various chemical constituents of Venus' atmosphere, including water vapor. And the mass spectrometer said there was a good deal more water vapor and sulfur dioxide than the gas chromatograph said. Well, then the Russians came along, and they landed on Venus, and they took measurements on the way down, too, and they also flew on each of their two spacecraft both a mass spectrometer and a gas chromatograph, and doggone if they didn't have the same discrepancy as we did. Well, a lot of fur flew as a result of that, and a lot of rethinking was done. And the latest is, and this is as of about 2 weeks ago, the latest is that it is now believed that the ugly duckling, the gas chromatograph, is the more reliable one, which means that there is not enough water vapor and sulfur dioxide to totally explain the additional greenhouse effect, and we need something else. It's possible that something else is sheer interior heat from Venus. Maybe Venus is very volcanically active, but it is unlikely that that is really a significant heat source. Certainly it isn't on the Earth, where only one part in 300 of the heat that is keeping you warm right now, for example, comes from, well, I mean, it would be if we were outdoors, obviously they heat the building, but, you know, the heat that keeps the atmosphere of the Earth warm, only one part in 300 of that comes from inside the planet, and we have reason to believe that Venus, the planet inside, is not terribly different from the Earth. So, in fact, there are probably other things involved. For example, there may be large-scale circulation, large-scale wind of the atmosphere, which compress the air over large portions of the surface of the planet by amounts that are actually great enough to do the job. You know, when you squeeze a gas, when you compress it, in other words, that heats it. You can detect that very easily by the gadget you're most likely to have for squeezing gases around your home, and that is a bicycle pump. And everybody knows that if you repeatedly compress some air in the chamber of a bicycle pump and then feel the bicycle pump, it is very, very hot. And the reason for that is it's heated up the air by compression inside it, and of course the air is then heated up the bicycle pump itself. And it can be so hot you can burn yourself if you're not careful. So that's the latest on the greenhouse effect of Venus, and that is something that is brand new. I know there are people in the audience who have heard me give Pioneer Venus Update lectures before, earlier this year, and I wanted to give you at least something that you hadn't heard before, and there it is. That's the biggest new one at the moment. Note, by the way, the nature of this great, new, wonderful thing that I am telling you. What I'm saying is we have advanced to the point where we don't know something we thought we understood very well a few months earlier. That is the way science somehow has to progress. The third thing that you would notice, if you were standing on the surface of Venus and you could somehow manage to survive both the heat and the pressure, is that the clouds that you noticed on the way in were kind of different from the clouds that you have on the Earth. For one thing, they're not honest, solid, thick, dense clouds that you can't see through the way the clouds on the Earth are if you fly through them in an airplane. Instead, they are a thin smog. They are very thick in terms of vertical height. You know, from the top to the bottom is something like 15 miles, depending on exactly how you define the clouds, because there's these very thin haze layers at the top and at the bottom. If you add those, you double the cloud thickness. But everywhere within the clouds, the density is low. It's sort of like a smog. In most places, you can see several miles. And in fact, through most of the Venus cloud layer, if this were on Earth and you were flying a light plane, you could legally fly by visual flight rules rather than having to go on instruments, assuming that they were made of something a little bit more benign. Because I say the best to last, what they're made of. Needless to say, ever since we discovered that Venus is so bright as a result of being covered by clouds, and you know, that's the reason it's called Venus. Because it is so bright and therefore so beautiful. And the reason Venus is so bright is, number one, it is the closest planet to the Earth, but number two, it is covered by these brilliant reflective white clouds, almost white, they're a little bit yellow. And people had wondered what they were, and of course the obvious first suggestion was, well, they're made of the same things as the clouds on Earth, that is, little droplets of liquid water. And then we discovered how hot Venus is at the surface. No, I guess first we discovered how cold the clouds were. Clouds are very high above the surface, and their tops are actually 150 below zero Fahrenheit, even though the surface way down below them is 900 above zero Fahrenheit. And you probably know that it gets colder as you go up in the atmosphere of a planet, at least for a while. So the next suggestion was they were made of the same things as the highest and therefore coldest clouds in the Earth, the cirrus clouds. We had some today, we had more yesterday, and those are made of little crystals of frozen water, in other words, of ice. And there were other suggestions. Maybe they're not really clouds at all. Maybe Venus is covered by a planet-wide dust storm. And it goes on all the time, the way Mars has a dust storm that goes on occasionally when Mars is nearest to the Sun and therefore hottest. Something about the solar heat triggers winds which raise dust into the Martian atmosphere. Well, maybe this happened all the time on Venus because Venus is so much closer to the Sun, so much hotter all the time than Mars ever gets. And there were more exotic suggestions, of which my favorite was that they were petroleum. But, and the whole planet was covered by an ocean of petroleum. That was due to Fred Hoyle in the mid-1950s, and, you know, Fred, where are you now when we need you? But nobody gets the right answer. And we found it out just a few years ago, and we found it out from Earth. So I want you to realize there is still plenty for our Earth-based telescopes to do. The clouds of Venus turn out to be made of liquid droplets, like the clouds on the Earth, but it's not water. It's concentrated sulfuric acid. So you've got to imagine yourself standing there on the surface of Venus with your spacecraft slowly melting around you and the air trying to crush you like an eggshell, and all of a sudden it begins to rain sulfuric acid. This is the planet, the ancient Romans named for the goddess of love and beauty. Venus is, in fact, so bright that you can see it in broad daylight, as in this picture. Let me make that very, very sharp. I took this from Ann Arbor. This is the Burton Tower, the bell tower, as everybody calls it on campus, for those of you who know the U of M campus. You can see I took it at 11:15 in the morning, and there, in broad daylight, is the planet Venus. Okay? People in the back probably can't. People in the front, I imagine, can't. It's not even hard to see if you are looking in exactly the right direction. If you look a little bit off to one side, it disappears immediately. And so, of course, all through history, there have been people who accidentally looked in the right direction and happened to see it, and depending on the mythology prevalent in their time and culture, interpreted as an angel, a devil, a god. Of course, today it's a flying saucer. Venus, whether by day or by night, especially by night when it's so bright that you can see it, it'll cast shadows all by itself under the right conditions. And people have no idea, most people have no idea that there are any natural objects that are that bright. And Venus is, in fact, the most commonly reported, the most common single object or phenomenon that is reported as a UFO. About two-thirds of all UFO reports are probably Venus. For example, the UFO that President Carter reported back when he was governor of Georgia in 1969 was Venus. Which is kind of embarrassing considering Carter is supposed to have learned navigation in the Navy, but that's another story. Anyway, you know, I'm not knocking my name. I'm delighted President Carter is so interested in Venus. I hope he keeps it up. But Venus is visible in daylight. You know where to look, and it looks exactly the way the moon does in daylight, that same chalky white appearance with a hint of blue around it.
except that it's simply a dot of light, and the moon, of course, is an extended source. Well, this is what we knew about Venus, basically, from the Earth. It's a little bit more than that, but I really hit the high point. If I were giving a Venus lecture 10 years ago, that's about where I would have stopped. But this is not 10 years ago, so I'm happy to say you can't go home yet. The first spacecraft to Venus that sent back any pictures, it was by no means the first spacecraft to Venus, but the first one in which anybody put a camera was Mariner 10. This is a painting by the great space artist Chesley Bonestell, which was made before the mission, and shows Mariner 10 coming around from the dark part of Venus, the dark side, approaches from the night side, and just beginning to swing around on the day side, so it's beginning to see its crescent for the first time. The reason that it did this is that Venus was in a position such that, which it takes up very rarely, such that if you send a spacecraft to Venus, you could use Venus's gravity to deflect the direction and change the speed of the spacecraft by exactly the right amount to send it onto a second planet, namely Mercury. And Mariner 10 was the first spacecraft to Mercury, and in fact, excuse me, the first spacecraft to visit more than one planet in succession. It reached Mercury a little bit less than 2 Earth months after it reached Venus. And the main reason that it had a camera was that we knew we wanted pictures of Mercury. Nobody had bothered to put a camera on Venus spacecraft up to that point because they figured, what's the use? Everybody knows it's totally covered with clouds, so there's nothing to see. And finally, it occurred to them there might be something to see in the clouds. And in fact, it was this Mercury spacecraft that was the first. Obviously, if you're sending spacecraft with good cameras on a past Venus, you're not going to keep them turned off, you know. And in fact, since Venus is closer to the Earth, it ended up sending back more pictures of Venus than of Mercury, 5,000 of them. Well, in fact, whereas it sent 3,000 of Mercury. In fact, the skeptics were almost right. Most of the pictures of the clouds of Venus, namely those taken at any wavelength that the human eye can see. I should explain, the television camera had a bunch of color filters in front of it. You could take a picture restricted to a particular color. Excuse me. And there are various reasons for doing this, one of which is to reassemble color pictures. But the camera is not restricted to the colors the eye can see. It can also see ultraviolet. Ultraviolet cannot be seen by the eye, but it can be photographed, and it can be picked up by a television camera such as this one. And in fact, any old black and white roll of film that you buy in the drugstore records ultraviolet as well as the visible colors. In fact, when film was first discovered, was first invented rather, all it would pick up was ultraviolet and the very shortest wavelength blue. And so people complain the pictures look unnatural, they don't look the way we see with the eye, and millions of dollars have been invested, I'm sure much more than that, by the photo companies to develop films that pick up the colors that we see as well. Well, in all of the colors that are visible to the naked eye, the clouds of Venus, even from as close as Mariner 10 got, 3,300 miles above the cloud top, were simply featureless like this. This is a picture which is a little more than 3,000 miles wide, and so you're going from part of the day side of Venus on over towards where it's becoming night. It isn't quite night yet. And the only thing that you see on this picture, aside from the shading from day to night, is the various black dots which are not on Venus. They're there. Some of them, the ones in the geometric array, are there because they were put inside the television camera on the faceplate, the gadget that picks up the image, the equivalent of the film in your camera, the retina in your eye, in order to make sure that those images would get transmitted back to the Earth, and therefore we could see that there had been no geometric distortion in the transmission. And the other things you see here are just dust that has been picked up by the picture in the various generations of copying. So you can see there just is nothing that is visible in any of the wavelengths that are visible to the naked eye. But in ultraviolet, it is a very, very different story. When you take pictures in ultraviolet, all of a sudden, this seemingly featureless cloud blanket shows a rich wealth of detail, like that. Now, I've got to explain immediately that color is totally fake, all right? What they did was, they were trying, and I didn't think it was a good idea. It seemed like a good idea at the time, but I'm not sure it was, because everybody, you know, the explanation I'm about to give you is almost never given. Everybody sees the picture thinks it's Venus and blue like the Earth. You know, to the extent that I've shown this picture in planetarium shows at the University of Michigan, and ask kids what planet they think it is, invariably they say it's the Earth. Well, it's not. It's totally covered by clouds, but, you know, you have to have a little bit of sophistication to realize that. And besides, the Earth is a lot. Behind you, the view is taken in a narrow band of wavelengths. In other words, it's only one color. It's not the equivalent of a white light view. They couldn't color it correctly. They couldn't color it ultraviolet, or you couldn't see it. So they did the next best thing. They colored it the closest color that you could see to ultraviolet, and that's blue. The equivalent would have been if they'd taken a blue picture, but human beings couldn't see blue, so they had to color it green. Okay, something like that. And as I say, I think it's a bad idea. The other thing that you've got to understand is that all four of these pictures have been very, very contrast enhanced. In other words, the contrast on them has been jacked up by a factor of over 100. Sort of like turning up the contrast knob on your television all the way and then multiplying that by 20 or 40 or something like that. So this is definitely not what you would have seen if you had been there on the spacecraft looking at Venus with the eye. You would have seen the featureless globe that is what you see from Earth. Even if you had eyes that could see ultraviolet, you would not see this because your eyes would not be showing you the picture in the set of contrast. What you would see would be a very slight difference between the very darkest regions and the very brightest regions. This would appear a little bit darker than this. So please understand, these pictures are useful. If you exaggerate the contrast, you can see a lot of things that you wouldn't be able to see otherwise, but you've got to understand that they are not... You have to understand the nature of the changes that have been made here. Well, first of all, the equator of Venus is running through here like so. The North Pole is out of sight behind the edge of the planet over there. The South Pole is right about there. So you are seeing primarily the Southern Hemisphere. And the first thing that draws itself to your attention, probably, is that Venus, like Jupiter, seems to have a cloud system that is broken up into parallel bright and dark stripes. In the case of Jupiter, we knew at the time these Venus pictures were taken what those were, because Pioneer 10 had already been out to Jupiter. It was in 1973, and it had sent back data that showed us that on Jupiter, the bright clouds, the bright stripes, are clouds that are higher up. The dark stripes are places where there are holes in those higher clouds, and you're able to see through them further into the atmosphere to a darker layer of clouds below. And the reason for that is Jupiter is hotter on the inside than it is on the outside, and what Pioneer 10 found out is the dark stripes are hotter than the bright stripes. Therefore, they are lower in the atmosphere. At the time these Mariner 10 pictures were taken, we didn't know whether the same thing was true on Venus. Whether the bright stripes were higher or the dark stripes were lower, or maybe the other way around. Maybe the dark stripes were places where there was cloud that was higher up than the brighter things, that was hiding the brighter things. Or the third possibility, which actually at the time I got to admit seemed most likely, although it's not true, and that is that excuse me, all of them were in the same layer, and the dark ones, which remember please, are only slightly darker than the bright ones, and then only darker in the ultraviolet, okay? Invisible light, they reflect the same amount of color, the same amount of light, so you don't see any difference, but that those darker ones were places where there was some sort of chemical impurity that was causing the ultraviolet to be reflected a little bit less. Pioneer Venus has found out the answer for it. It turns out that Venus is like Jupiter. The upper layer of clouds is colder and is therefore higher, and there are places in it where not there are holes. Remember, the difference between the dark and bright is very small, but where there are thinnings in the uppermost layer of the clouds so that you can see down through dimly to an ultraviolet darker, though visibly just as bright, region that is below them. To be more specific, Pioneer Venus found out that Venus has three major layers of clouds, which have cleverly been named the upper cloud layer, the middle cloud layer, and the lower cloud layer. Or, if you wish, layers D, C, and B. And that those three layers are, of those three layers, we are seeing, of course, the top of the uppermost one, the D layer, in these pictures. And in the places where there are thinnings in the D layer, you are able to see through the D layer and get a faint view of the C layer, the middle cloud layer, which is the thinnest, although the densest, of the lot that is down underneath it. And I will show you a very detailed map of the structure of the clouds of Venus a little bit later on, so I want to drop that thing about the layers for the time being. But there's another question, which is, what is the substance that causes this darkening? Remember, it has got to be something that, first of all, could reasonably be expected to be present in the clouds of Venus, given their chemistry. So we ruled out mayonnaise from the beginning, you know. Peanut butter seemed unlikely. To give a more serious example, water is not a reasonable possibility because those clouds are made of sulfuric acid, and sulfuric acid is a very, very good drying agent, and if there were tiny amounts of water that were present as droplets, I'm not talking about the vapor that's in the air below the clouds that I mentioned a little while ago, but if there were water that was present as droplets in the clouds, the sulfuric acid droplets would have just gobbled them all up, and all you would have had would be slightly more dilute sulfuric acid. So it had to be something chemically reasonable up there.
It also has to be something that reflects just as much light in the ultra, in the visible region, as little droplets of sulfuric acid do, so that you do not see it as darker in visible light, and yet that absorbs ultraviolet, and therefore does not reflect quite as much ultraviolet as do the sulfuric acid droplets. There were very few substances that seemed reasonable. And of all the ones that seemed reasonable, the leading candidates were sulfur. You know, you got sulfuric acid in the clouds, so why not sulfur as well? Sulfur present as little crystals floating around in the clouds among the sulfuric acid droplets. And the other leading candidate, which at the moment is the one that the Pioneer Venus scientists prefer, although by no means is this analysis settled yet, is a gas called sulfur dioxide. And you remember I mentioned that there was more of that below the clouds than people expected. But if there is some mixed in among the clouds, and for some reason you have these thinnings in the top cloud layer, and you can see down the sulfur dioxide in the layer, level of the middle cloud layer in those places, then you would get this kind of appearance. Sulfur dioxide is transparent in the visible, but it does absorb ultraviolet. Needless to say, there are more exotic suggestions as well to give you an idea of how desperate some people got in trying to agree with the data, in trying to find substances that would do this very peculiar thing of, number one, being chemically reasonable in those clouds, and number two, absorb ultraviolet but reflect visible light. One thing that was seriously suggested was bromine dissolved in hydrobromic acid and present as small droplets of this stuff in the, as we would now think of it, the middle cloud layer. Whatever the nature of the light and dark markings that you're seeing here, one thing is obvious, and that is you're seeing the effects of wind. Okay? Does that seem intuitively reasonable from where you're sitting? I mean, that's the reason for these clouds. And a major difference between the clouds of Venus and the clouds of Jupiter is the clouds of Jupiter are stripes that are all parallel to the equator. In other words, each stripe is at a given latitude. So if you turn Jupiter around 90 degrees and light it up so the whole hemisphere was visible, you would see a bullseye effect, a target effect. Indeed, I will show you exactly such a picture that was synthesized in Voyager 1 images. That is not true on Venus. These stripes, these bright stripes, are not, and therefore the dark stripes between them, are not parallel to the equator, they're inclined to it. And in fact, what is happening is, in each hemisphere, you have a continuous spiral which begins up near the equator and wraps round and round the planet until finally it merges with the only one of the stripes that really is, because we're not behind a planet there, the only one of the stripes that really is along the same latitude, that really is parallel to the equator, and that is the so-called polar ring, which is a 70 degrees latitude in the southern hemisphere, and over there at the edge of the planet, another polar ring in the northern hemisphere. And then the polar ring apparently marks the boundary between two major wind regimes on Venus. You have this continuous spiral of wind up to the, from the equator up to the polar ring, and then between the polar ring and the pole, you have another spiral, a very tight one, called the polar vortex, which isn't very obvious in this picture because it's so foreshortened, but in fact, there is a spiral there. So what's your market? We like the spiral you generate by letting the water out of your bathtub and observing the motion around the drain. So let's talk first about the circulation from the equator up to the polar ring. When the Mariner 10 meteorologists saw these pictures, they jumped up and down and screamed for joy and did other undignified things because that was a perfect illustration in nature of something that up until then had only been a textbook concept. And it's in chapter 3 of every elementary meteorology textbook that's ever been written, and it's called a Hadley circulation. I should explain the word circulation as used in meteorology means nothing more and nothing less than wind. Okay? In other words, moving air from one place to another. But see, if the meteorologist said wind, you would understand what they were talking about, so they say circulation. And Hadley said, Hadley was the father of meteorology. He was an Astronomer Royal of England. He did things like invent the sextant, and Hadley Rill on the moon where Apollo 15 landed was named for him, but in his spare time he became the father of meteorology. I do not know who was the mother of meteorology, but Hadley is always listed as his father. Hadley said, here is the way the circulation on a planet ought to go. Can we give just enough light that people can see my arms wave without destroying everybody's dark adaptation? Is there one set of dim light somewhere that we could have? Because I just realized that this cord is not... Oh, yes it is, yes it is. Okay, here are my cancellers left. Continue. Oh, fine, excellent. All right. Yeah, but I thought the cord was not going to allow me to move this far into it. Hadley said, okay, here is the hemisphere of the planet. Here's the equator and here's the pole.
The air is hottest at the equator, therefore it rises. The air is coldest at the pole, therefore it sinks. Well, the rising air can't go on rising forever, and the air can't go on sinking at the pole forever and ever because it's got to be replaced by new air somewhere. And since both these things are happening simultaneously, what's going to happen in fact is the air is going to rise at the equator and get sucked up to the pole where it will become the same air that is sinking. And then as it falls down to the ground, it will return to the equator along the ground to complete the cycle. And that is known as the Hadley circulation, except there's one further twist to it. I do need twist, because the planet is rotating. And so if the planet were not rotating, the motion would be strictly due north in the northern hemisphere, strictly due south in the southern hemisphere, in other words, directly from the equator to the pole along meridian. But because the planet is rotating, this nice, simple meridional circulation is twisted into a spiral. And chapter 3 of every elementary meteorology textbook, having explained the Hadley circulation, then goes on to explain that we don't see it on Earth. And the reason we don't see it on Earth is that Earth is too complicated a planet. Earth has a very rapid rotation, which not only twists the circulation into a spiral, but breaks it into pieces. I'm being a little bit metaphorical there, but that basically is the effect. And so we have, the pieces are our high and low pressure systems. They're constantly going by from west to east of the weather map, if you watch it from night to night every night. And furthermore, the Earth has, meteorology is complicated by the fact that there are places on the Earth where there is water, and that has all kinds of effects on the air, because when it is evaporated, when it's sucked up by the air from the ocean, it ejects heat into the atmosphere. That heat is released when the water is turned into liquid. And yet there are other places where that doesn't happen or doesn't happen nearly as much. These are over land. And so this alternation, the winds have, as they go across the boundaries between land and sea and land, really mess up the circulation. Well, Venus is a planet that has a much simpler weather than the Earth. Indeed, that was the big reason for going to Venus, for having these atmospheric missions at Venus. These were the first missions, Pioneer Venus especially, was the first mission in history devoted primarily to the atmosphere of another planet as opposed to its surface and interior. And I'm not saying that one is good and the other is bad, I'm simply saying they're both important. We've got to understand surface and interior, we want to understand geology, we want to understand why there are earthquakes and volcanic eruptions on the Earth. A single earthquake in China a few years ago killed more people than the U.S. lost in the entire Vietnam War. If we could somehow learn how earthquakes operate, we might be able to prevent that kind of tragedy. And there is every reason to believe that we can do that by going to other worlds that are different from our own and seeing what they're like and seeing in what respects they're similar, in what respects they're different, where there are quakes, where there are not, where there's volcanic activity, where there is not, and use this sort of insight to get a deeper understanding of our own planet. But the same thing is true of meteorology. We desperately need to understand how weather operates on the Earth, and again, it is very likely, in fact, it has already happened, that we will get insights by studying other planets' weather, which we can then apply to our own. And obviously, if you want to understand planetary meteorology, the place where you're going to go is to start out with is where it's simple. Well, not the very simple, such as the Moon, which has the simplest meteorology, but there is none. There's no air. But aside from that zero order case, by far the simplest meteorology in the solar system is Venus. Venus has no difference between sea and land. I guarantee there are no oceans on the surface of Venus at a temperature of 900 degrees. Venus has no difference in temperature from one place to another. Venus has a very cold rotation. Venus has an atmospheric greenhouse that is due not to minor trace constituents, which can vary an amount in complex ways with time and space over the planet, the way you have on Earth, where the greenhouse is due to carbon dioxide and water vapor. Venus is a planet where the temperature is determined by a greenhouse that is primarily due to the major constituent of the atmosphere, the carbon dioxide that makes up over 95% of the Venus atmosphere, and therefore is stable, and it's just easier to understand the circulation on Venus, how to understand the weather on Venus. And so there, lo and behold, is exactly what James Hadley predicted so many years ago. There is a Hadley circulation. Hadley was absolutely right. He had the wrong planet. But, okay, we're going to have the room lights down now again. Hadley can have everything. And that means that our understanding of meteorology, even on this simple planet, was not perfect. Why does the Hadley circulation stop at the polar ring? Why is there a different circulation in this thing called the vortex, the polar vortex? Why is there a region over here, the region that is under the sun,
sometimes it's been given the name, sometimes the Eye of Venus, because that's the one place where the heavy circulation diverges and flows around it. And there is something there which looks remarkably like convection. That is the process of boiling, of overturning, of a fluid that has been heated from below. Air is a fluid. Does everybody know that? Fluid does not mean liquid, as so many people seem to think. It means something that can flow, i.e. a gas or a liquid. You know, people like me who have colds are giving the advice, stay home and drink plenty of fluid. Well, I never drink solids anyway, so it's useless advice. I've had a bit, I know what people can tell me. I mean, stay home and drink a lot has an entirely different connotation. But, back to me. All you ever drink are fluid. Exactly. Tell them to drink that. A fluid which is heated from below and is in a gravitational field and has certain other things we don't have to worry about will overturn, and the motion is exactly the same as boiling water in a tea kettle. You know, where you've got a fluid that's being heated from below, and it's in a gravitational field, and the other things are correct too. And so you have this overturn. The water rises up in little cells, loses heat at the surface, therefore becomes denser and sinks back down to the bottom where it gets heated again, so forth and so on. Air and Venus will go through the same thing there. Otherwise, there is no indication of convection, at least in the pictures of the cloud. Now, one of the things the Pioneer Venus probes measured on their way down through the air was whether there was convection at any level, whether you could see it from outside or not. And in fact, it turns out that almost the whole way down, there were four places where they landed, and unfortunately, we were not able to land any of them in the Eye of Venus. But simply technological considerations prevented it. It's not as though anybody was happy with that, but there's nothing we can do about it. But the four places where we did land, almost the whole way down, there was no convection. There were a couple of levels where there was just a little bit of very sluggish convection. And so this means that the air on Venus is very stable, it's very stagnant. When you have smog in Los Angeles, the way they did so terribly last week, well, what's happening is there's no convection. See, there's no overturn of the air. This junk stays where it is because the air is just sitting there in static layers rather than there being an overturn, an overflow to haul the materials away and make them be replaced by fresh air. And it's not until the situation change and convection can start up again that Los Angeles gets some amazing smog. Please note something that I said that may not have been obvious. I mean, it was implied, but I didn't come out with it directly. Venus has no storms. There is nothing, since it is a heavy circulation, and not just broken up into blob sites that we have on the Earth, or to give it its official name, a Rossby wave circulation, there are no highs and lows on Venus. It's always just about the same barometric pressure, and the air is flowing smoothly from the places where there's a little bit higher pressure, namely the region around the equator where the air is heated and therefore there's more pressure, to the region up there at the polar ring. But whatever stops the polar ring, you don't understand, and that must be a region where the barometric pressure is low. On Earth, this sort of happens. If you look at a weather satellite picture, you won't see it, but if you look on a given day, because there are high and low pressure systems even around the equator, but they're not as strong, they're not as dominant as they are up in our latitude, the laughingly referred to temperate latitude. If you look at average statistics over a long time and make a map of what the pressure and temperature and so forth is like on the Earth then, you find there is a sort of Hadley circulation from the equator up to about latitude 30 degrees. So you can't make it all the way to the pole. There is so much twisting due to the planet's rotation that there is just no way the air can make it all the way up to the pole. You have an even more extreme situation on Jupiter where air tries to move just a little bit north or south, and immediately, because of the phenomenal rotation you have on Jupiter, this whole thing is going around every 10 hours. You know, it's 1,000 times the size of the Earth, it's going around every 10 hours. So you have enormously strong twisting due to the rotation, and air tries to start moving north-south, and it just gets grabbed around and moves practically east-west. And that, in a nutshell, is at least a reason for the band of structure on Jupiter. But I'll get to that when we get to the Jupiter lecture. Anyway, you have a sort of heavy circulation from the equator up to latitude 30 degrees. And then from about 30 degrees up to, oh, it depends on the season, but somewhere around 60, 65, 70 degrees, you have this Rossby wave circulation that I talked about, the highs and the lows going back and forth, that you're so familiar with in the weather maps because we live in that region. And then up here at the pole, you have a, well, it's not really like the polar vortex. I don't want to try to get into it. It's not relevant to Venus and would take up too much of our time. But you really have these three different regimes on the Earth. And at the boundary, the equator is the boundary, right? And 30 degrees is the boundary. And that's a place where nothing much is happening. because the Hadley circulation, as say at the equator, the Hadley circulation is falling back, and the Rossi wave circulation hasn't really gotten started yet. So in a band around 30 degrees north and south at the Earth, you have very little weather, you have very little wind, you have very little precipitation. And it's those latitudes where most of the great deserts of the Earth are, see, so little precipitation. It is those latitudes where the Sargasso Sea is in the Atlantic. Those are what the old mariners called the horse latitudes, because often they would be calm for so long, you know, back in the sailing days, and the only source of power they had was wind, that it got to the point where there was enough ration for the people or the horses, but not both, and the horses had to be killed and thrown overboard. So that's where the strange term horse latitudes came from. At the equator, there is another stagnant region. That's what's called the doldrums by everybody except the meteorologists, who insist on referring to it as the intertropical convergence zone. But the doldrums is a more characteristic term, because it really gets the idea across. Well, Venus has a doldrum. It has a sort of horse latitude at the polar ring, and then it has this polar vortex, which really doesn't correspond to anything we have on the Earth. Okay, now all this that I just told you, with the exception of the nature of the light and dark markings, was known at the time of Mariner Chance. So if I had given a Venus lecture 5 years ago, I could have said almost all the things that I've said up to this point. Mariner Chance taught us one other thing too, and that is there are unbelievable winds at the cloud layers, and probably a little above and a little below, we didn't know how far above and below. Let me refocus the slide so you can see the bottom three pictures better. Here is a feature about the size of the United States, which has been blown to 7 hours later its entire diameter westward. Here it is having moved more than some diameter westward 7 hours after that. That is, or I said the size of the United States, I'm sorry, from east to west, it is about as big as the United States is from north to south. So it's the size of the United States in a short dimension. You have winds in those cloud layers of 200 to 300 miles an hour. And the effect of that, now there's no wind down at the ground. The strongest gust of wind that has ever been measured at the surface of Venus was 1.2 miles per hour. Now remember, in an atmosphere that dense, that's not negligible. That exerts a fair amount of pressure. It exerts about as much pressure as a 12 mile an hour breeze would be on Earth. The way you do it, for those of you who are into mathematics and wish I would give an occasional equation now and then, is that you take the square root of the density. You scale it to the square root of the density. So if the density is 100 times greater on Venus, square root of 100 is 10, so you multiply by 10 to get what wind would be the same pressure on the Earth. And that's a 12 mile an hour wind. If you're interested in erosion, it's a lot more complicated. Basically what it comes down to is there's probably very little. In many ways, if you want to visualize what it's like at the surface of Venus, as far as the air pressure goes and the density of the air, don't think about standing at the bottom of the air on Earth. Think about standing at the bottom of water on Earth. That air at the surface of Venus is only 8 times less dense than water. And for example, the large probes, the small probes are an even better example. The small probes on Pioneer Venus didn't even have parachutes. Would you need a parachute if you were trying to land, you know, sink down in the ocean? Okay. The only difference is that, well, there are two differences. One, this fluid does not have a well-defined top the way the ocean does. And secondly, this is a gas. It is compressible. Water is a liquid. It is incompressible and therefore obeys some very different laws of physics. Or let's say the laws of physics express themselves in very different ways. But if you're trying to think in terms of density, think in terms of floating down through the ocean, and you'll get a better idea. And so people say, well, you got this very, very dense air. Couldn't it pick up sediment from the surface, assuming you can somehow generate sediment? And we know, in fact, from the Venera 9 and 10 picture, that somehow sediment is generated on the surface of Venus. We're not at all sure why. Sediment generation on Earth is pretty much due to liquid water. And if there's one thing you do not have, and especially liquid water freezing and then melting and freezing and melting in the temperate regions as the seasons change, I guarantee you don't have that on Venus. But for whatever reason, there is sediment on the surface of Venus. And people say, couldn't the wind pick that stuff up and blow it around and do tremendous amounts of damage? And the answer is no. Did you ever try to pick up a glob of sand underwater and throw it at somebody underwater? If you ever had that experience, you will vividly understand what I mean when we say we don't expect very much wind erosion on the surface of Venus. Just too dense. It just prevents the sand grains from moving very far. Yeah? Well, it's a very good question. The problem is I answered it at length in the last lecture series. Basically, it is Venus and not the Earth that is the normal one. The air on this kind of planet is not a gas that has been left over unchanged from the origin of the planet. Okay? The proof of that is too long and complicated to give here. I did give it last time, so, you know, I've just got to give you the overview here. believe it, it is true. The air that we have on this kind of planet, well, the terrestrial planets, the Earth-type planets, Venus, Earth, Mars, the Moon, Mercury, Moon and Mercury haven't been able to keep any atmosphere, the gravity is too little. But these planets were very hot, melted entirely, in fact, during or immediately after their formation. And that heat, and maybe some other heat as well from outside, drove off whatever primeval atmosphere they may have had, whatever primitive atmosphere they may have had. It's simply gone. And there's a lot of proof of that, one of which is the two most common gases in the universe by far are hydrogen and helium. In fact, 99% of all the atoms in the universe are hydrogen and helium. The Earth's gravity is not strong enough to keep hydrogen, but it is strong enough to keep helium at our temperature. And if the Earth had always been this temperature, there'd be tremendous amounts of helium around the atmosphere, and there's not. Neon is a substance that is very common in the universe as a whole and practically non-existent in the Earth's atmosphere. If our atmosphere were primordial, we'd have a lot of neon. Okay, I've ended up giving you the proof that I just told you I wasn't going to. Those are two of the prime examples. But instead, we lost our primeval atmosphere, if in fact we ever had any. Maybe the formation of the Earth and the loss of that atmosphere were going on simultaneously. And then, when the Earth cooled down a bit, and at least the outer part solidified, we still had volcanoes, and there was gas that had been chemically combined with the materials inside the Earth, and therefore had escaped being boiled off because it wasn't gas. And I'm talking, for example, about water, which is chemically combined with rock-forming minerals, what is called water of hydration. And I'm talking about carbon dioxide, which can get tied up in rocks such as limestone. That actually came around later, but that's a complex story. Nitrogen tied up in nitrates and so forth. And slowly, these materials, through continuing chemical reactions underground, became changed into the gases that we are talking about. And of course, water is a gas when it first comes out of the inside of the Earth, right? It's steam. And slowly, through geologic history, the process is still going on today, the Earth has been losing these materials through volcanic eruptions and outgassing. The Earth interior, rather, has been losing these materials through volcanic eruptions and geysers and fumaroles and hot springs and all those things, a process collectively called outgassing. And that is where the present-day atmosphere of the Earth came from. Well, if you go to a volcano and you find out what the Earth outgasses, you will find it is mostly water. Actually, most of that is recycled groundwater, rain that is soaked a few miles down into the ground, happened to get caught up in the volcanic eruption, comes back out again, so it's not fair to count that, it's being recycled. But even when you take out that water, more than anything else that comes out of a volcano is what is called juvenile water. That is water that has never before been on the surface of the Earth. In the case of the Earth, our temperature is such that that material, which ought to be the major constituent of the atmosphere, does not remain a gas. It becomes liquid, and it forms these big puddles lying around all over the place, which we call oceans. So, the Earth's atmosphere would be made mostly of water vapor if it weren't for that. After the water vapor, by far the most abundant material that is outgassed is carbon dioxide. About three-quarters of the stuff that is outgassed is, ignoring the recycled groundwater, about three-quarters of the new material, the juvenile material that is outgassed is water, and practically all the rest is carbon dioxide. So you see, we ought to have a Venus-type atmosphere on this planet. We ought to have, well, there's 100 times as much carbon dioxide outgas as everything else put together. So we ought to have an atmosphere that is about 100 times as dense as we have and that is made almost exclusively of carbon dioxide, and on Venus that is exactly what you see. So it is Venus and not the Earth that is the normal one. A distant third in the outgassing product is nitrogen, and that, by default, is the major gas that makes up the atmosphere of the Earth today. Of course, the second major gas is oxygen. That is not produced directly by outgassing. That comes from the water vapor, from the water, in the process of photosynthesis. And at this point, about 80% of you want to jump down my throat and say, no, it comes from the carbon dioxide. Believe it or not, it comes from the water. Photosynthesis requires both carbon dioxide and water, so it's an academic question. But if you're interested, radioactive tracer studies have shown that the oxygen that the plant releases comes from the water, the H2O, and not from the CO2, the carbon dioxide, even though it wouldn't have happened if it wasn't the carbon dioxide. Ah, you see, that's the question. Suddenly you realize that the kind of question that you ask, why is it?